session number 15240, reel 2.
Mr. Hamilton, reel 2. You were just telling me how the crew of the Bismarck fought.
Well, we were full of admiration for them. They had done a marvellous job. And as I think I mentioned, the ship itself was one of the finest products ever from a shipbuilding yard.
How did you feel when you heard the news that the Bismarck had gone down?
Well, it was inevitable, in spite of her strength. It was inevitable that she would go down. But we had no inkling, of course, whether the Germans themselves had opened a seacock or whether she had, in fact, sunk due to gunfire. It was a sad sight. But, of course, the Royal Navy had to sink the Bismarck. There's no question. After she had sunk the Hood, Jutland again, of course, due to defective anti-flash arrangements, and it was inevitable. I mean, we had to sink the Bismarck, and we would have done anything. No, I'm sorry, I haven't made a hash of that. You have to cut the thing out.
That's all right. Yeah. Did you see the crew of the Bismarck jumping out of the ship?
Oh, of course, yes. And we were, the Mary and the Devonshire that happened to be handy. Devonshire was sent in by
the Dorsetshire.
Fraser, Dorsetshire, sorry, to torpedo the Bismarck and finish her off. But I doubt whether it made any difference. As you see, I'm a great admirer of the Bismarck.
Any other memories about the pursuit of the Bismarck and its sinking that you'd like to put down?
I don't think so. I come back to the point that it was the beginning of the air age and the end of the traditional role, R-O-L-E, of destroyers. The last time that they did that job, the hunting over a vast area of sea, the shadowing, the reporting, and the guaranteeing that the heavy ships would be able to deal with the situation. The typical destroyer role.
So you took the survivors back to Britain, did you, afterwards?
Yes.
Were there any burials at sea? Did any of the survivors die aboard ship?
I don't remember any burials at sea. No. The sad thing is, of course, I mentioned that we had to leave a lot of German sailors in the sea. I mean, because we had this U-boat scare. But I understand from subsequent reportings that there was a U-boat which did, in fact, pick up some of the survivors.
Now, can we leave the Bismarck and go on to your next memories of service in the Maori, please?
The next incident of note, the date of which I forget, was when the Maori was in company with Sikh, Zulu, and the Dutch boat Isaac Spheres on passage, minding our own business, from Gibraltar to Malta. And purely by chance, we ran into two Italian cruisers and four torpedo boats off Cape Bon. I think it took 3 minutes, but I may be inaccurate, to sink both the Italian cruisers and to scare the living daylights out of the four destroyers. We arrived in Malta, and I have never seen anything like the welcome. Every girl was leaning out of every window, waving her bra. It was a tremendous performance by the people of Malta. It was terrific. The cheers as we came into harbour were terrific. But to sink two cruisers in a matter of 4 minutes is quite remarkable. I should add that we were in a position to see the Italian ships, whereas because we were on the shore side, they could not see us in the against the Cape Bon Peninsula. And so it was very bad luck, if I can put it like that, on the Italians.
Did you see much of that action yourself?
Well, the alarm rattlers went indicating that something was amiss, and it just happened that we had a colonel of the Argyll and Sutherlands who was taking passage from Gibraltar to Malta, and we had a glass of port on the table. And I said to the colonel, we better go up onto the bridge quickly. So we went up onto the bridge, and by the time we got there, the two Italian cruisers were in flames, because we were the third ship in the line, and Gary Stokes in the Sikh and the Zulu had already torpedoed these ships, and they were sinking within literally a matter of minutes. And we still stood on the bridge and steamed past these flaming wrecks, and it was with difficulty that we managed to avoid them and not actually run into them. It was a most incredible action. It took literally a matter of a few minutes, and the two cruisers were sinking, and that was it. There was no question of stopping to pick up the Italian sailors, because they could virtually swim to Cape Bon if they had any, or be rescued from there. So we just carried on. I don't think the destroyers even left their station. They were still 1, 2, 3, 4, just carrying on as normal. It was the most extraordinary action. And when we arrived in Malta, the reception was fantastic. I don't think it's anything like it could ever have happened before.
And so this must have been in 1941, but obviously after May, when the Bismarck was sunk.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened to you in the Maori, please?
Well, then we then became enmeshed, I think is the word, with the whole business of supplying Malta. Convoys from Alexandria. That was a grim business. Malta was practically at its last gasp, and the heroic behavior of the merchant sailors and the captains of the merchant ships and the escort vessels was something which one would never forget. As, of course, you are aware, the Air Force, the enemy air force, could use bases in Sicily, and there was a part, the central part of the Mediterranean known as Bomb Alley, which was almost impossible to get through in spite of the bravery of the ship's companies and the escort vessels. There exists a marvelous book which has been published since the war, of which I have a copy here, giving details of every convoy, the merchant ships, every escort vessel, and what happened to them all, which I can show you.
Did you go ashore much yourself in Malta during the siege?
I have absolutely no recollection of going ashore at all. Obviously one did. But with the next episode of any real importance was the sinking of the Maori, which was purely accidental and has never, as far as I'm aware, been announced. There's an interesting story which my wife can tell you about, of a character who was in charge of the AA batteries near the Castile, who actually watched the Malta being, the Maori being sunk. There was, at that time, only one Maryland, I think, of our Air Force operational at the time. And the BBC would announce nightly that our air forces had been operating from Malta against the Germans in North Africa. And in fact, I believe at that time they were relating only to one aircraft, because we had very few which were operational. And on the night in question, Maori was at a buoy, swinging around a buoy in Grand Harbour, and the Penelope, a cruiser, which had been damaged, was nearby alongside a wall. In the middle of the night, while we were all asleep, in a pitch black night with no moon, a solitary aircraft approached the island, and the powers that be thought it was our own aeroplane coming back from a raid on North Africa. As it happened, it was a single enemy aircraft, which may or may not have been lost, which flew across the island and, with no purpose other than getting rid of the bombs, dropped a stick of bombs right across the island, any old how, higgledy-piggledy, and one of those bombs hit the Maori and blew the ship virtually in half. We were all asleep at the time. It was dark, and it was all totally unexpected. The ship caught fire, partly because the oil fuel tanks were ruptured and the sea in the harbour was covered in burning oil fuel, and partly because we think the torpedo warheads of the Maori were detonated by the explosion. I don't know if you want to hear any more details of this.
Please.
Well, I was the first lieutenant, of course. It just happened that my previous captain, who had taken over from Beaky Armstrong, had been appointed ashore. And a new captain, a lieutenant commander who was a submariner, had joined the ship only a little while before and had no particular affection for it. It was merely an appointment. And he left the ship, and I was the first lieutenant. I had been there since before the ship was finished by the builders and had been there throughout her career. And clearly, as the first lieutenant, it was my job to look after the sailors. The engineer officer and I swam round the burning oil from the after end of the ship and got back on board at the forward end. And we did our best to keep the ship afloat. We started at the foremost end, at the bow end, and cleared each compartment and closed all the doors and hammered them home in good Devonshire fashion until we came to those parts of the ship which were so ruptured that they could not be made watertight. And we then abandoned ship. Two of our people were killed. The gunner T, called Sidney White, who was a lovely man, a West Country man, a brilliant officer, marvellous fellow, and the sick berth attendant, those two were killed by the bomb. The rest of the ship's company, without loss, all swam to the Penelope. That was quite an achievement, considering the burning oil on the sea. I'm proud to say that the ship remained afloat for 36 hours, but finally the weight of water burst the compartments and she finally sank. It was the end of a ship which had a brilliant life and had the most marvellous ship's company of West Country sailors who are unequalled in the world.
I think you got a decoration for that, did you not?
Well, yes, I got my first DSC for that. Not that there was any particular reason, but I suppose the fact that we kept the ship afloat for 36 hours and that we got every sailor off without loss was partly fortuitous, and well, what more can I say?
What kind of state were you in yourself by the time you got to safety?
Well, I arrived alongside the Penelope in my pyjama trousers, and that's all. And the commander met me, Commander Grant, John Grant, and he said, "You might as well stay here, that is, in the Penelope, because there's no communication with anybody, the Admiralty or anybody else, at the moment. The whole situation is a mess. So you might as well stay here. We could do with another lieutenant anyway." So I said, "Thank you, sir. I'd be delighted and privileged." And that was how I joined the Penelope.
What kind of job were you given in the Penelope?
Well, I was really sort of extra, as it were, until the unfortunate gunnery officer, who Jackie Miller, was killed by one of his own shells, and I then took over as gunnery officer of the Penelope. I should explain that she was damaged and had been part of Force K, which consisted of the cruisers Penelope and Aurora, and two destroyers, the Lance and Lively. Force K had been a thorn in the side of Rommel, preventing, almost literally preventing, any reinforcements, fuel, ammunition, stores, or anything reaching the Africa Corps by destroying the convoys coming across from Italy. They did a magnificent job. And it was a great privilege to join a ship like the Penelope with this history of achievement and the marvelous spirit. She had a particularly meritorious and lovely man, Angus Nicol, as a captain, who in my opinion should have had a VC for subsequent operations. He was loved by his ship's company, who were extremely efficient, and it was a real privilege to join a ship like that.
What kind of duties did Penelope then take up after you joined her?
Well, you know, of course, about the Second Battle of Sirte, which was Vian's great triumph, when the Italian fleet, actually a battleship in point of fact, and cruisers came out in order to intercept a convoy which consisted of, I think, three or four merchant ships and the Breconshire, the famous grey funnel ship, which had done many runs from Alexandria with stores, ammunition, fuel, petrol, oil, spare parts, everything that was required. A very gallant ship that had made several runs from Alexandria. The Second Battle of Sirte was, of course, one of the great naval actions of the war, or indeed of any war, where vastly inferior British forces actually put to flight, I think is a fair comment, the Italian fleet, of which a battleship was present. It was the most brilliant action in which old-fashioned methods such as the laying of heavy smoke screens played a very important part. The sad thing is that of the three ships that arrived finally, the Talabot, the Pampas and the Breconshire, all three were finally destroyed in spite of the brilliant action in getting them to Malta in the first place. The most appalling moment in my life, without any question, was when the Penelope tried to tow the Breconshire, which had been disabled, into Grand Harbour. And shortly before we reached the breakwater, a cross wind made it impossible to get the Breconshire into Grand Harbour. And with the utmost regret and anguish, the tow had to be slipped, and the Breconshire drifted away. Finally, she anchored in Mazasharok Bay and was sunk there. Subsequently, due to great ingenuity, much of the oil and other essentials were in fact got out of the ship and into the dockyard. Of the two merchant ships that arrived, the Pampas was beached at the far end of Grand Harbour at Paola, and a good deal of her cargo was in fact saved. The Talabat, which was full of ammunition, had been hit and set on fire, and she lay stopped in the middle of Grand Harbour, blazing furiously and with the plating in some places red hot. I was in the dockyard at the time, and it was obvious that the fire had to be put out. Malta, as you probably, Valletta, I should say, to be more precise, had, as I'm sure you know, been devastated once before in history by an explosion. And it was quite obvious to anyone that if this ship full of ammunition in Grand Harbour blew up, Valletta would suffer a terrible fate, and not only the defences, but great many of the civilians and the buildings and everything else would be destroyed. It was a terrible moment. I collected two or three sailors that I could get hold of just by shouting at them, and we ran into the civilian part of the dockyard, and we commandeered a tug. I think her name was the Ancient, and we managed to get the Maltese crew to get the tug underway, and we took it alongside the Talabat to play the tug's hoses on the red-hot plating. Such was the heat that our efforts were of no avail whatsoever. And it was at this point that the torpedo officer of the Penelope, Lieutenant Commander Copperwheat, had the idea that if he could secure a charge alongside, actually to the plating of the Talabat, and detonate it, he could let in the sea and sink the ship, and that would, the water would put out the flames and stop the ammunition blowing up. As you must know from your records at the Imperial War Museum, Copperwheat secured the charge, a charge, alongside, actually on the plating of the Talabat, and he retreated towards the customs house, paying out as he went the electric wiring with which he would detonate the charge. He was unable to reach the shore because the wire was not long enough, and with the utmost courage he detonated the charge while he was still in a boat not all that far from the Talabat. The result was that he was severely wounded himself and subsequently awarded a George Cross, and the Talabat sank and Valletta was saved. That was one of the great moments of the Maltese War, and I can't say how much I admire Copperwheat, particularly as my own efforts were so unavailing.
Do you have any personal memories of the Second Battle of Sirte?
Yes. The interesting thing is that I've subsequently, in fact, the other day at a reunion in Blackpool, of all places, which adopted the Penelope, I was given a copy of a book about the Second Battle of Sirte, and I didn't realise until this February, which is 50 years on, that Angus Nicol, the captain of the Penelope, never received any orders as to what was to happen and what role, R-O-L-E, the ships were to play. And he merely followed Vian in order to support him if and when we met the Italian battle fleet. It was, in many ways, an extremely confusing battle because the ships are altering course throughout and smoke screens were being laid in all directions to hide the convoy from the Italian fleet. It really was a question of the most brilliant manoeuvring in very difficult conditions.
Were you on the bridge yourself?
Oh yes, of course.
What could you see of the Italian ships?
Well, we only caught glimpses of the Italian ships through the smoke at irregular intervals. It was, in fact, one shouldn't use the word confusing because that implies that we didn't know what we were doing, but it was a very confused situation with constant alterations of course and relaying of smoke screens as the wind, the position of the merchant ships and the position of the Italian ships dictated at any one moment.
Was the Penelope hit?
No. There was a destroyer near us hit. I've forgotten the name of which. It was one of the H boats was hit by a big shell. But none of our warships were sunk in that battle. As I've already mentioned, the sad thing is that the convoy which finally made it to the island was in the end totally destroyed. Although from the Pampas and subsequently from the Breconshire and indeed from the Talbot, a good deal of valuable material was saved.
I think you got a bar to your DSC at Malta at that time.
Well, no, it was subsequent to that, actually. Later on, as you know, and as history has recorded, the Penelope was in dry dock with damage to her bottom so that she could not be taken out. And there was a poignant, I think is the word, period during which the ship's own artificers and soldiers who were accustomed to using oxyacetylene equipment were welding patches on the bottom of the ship in the dry dock in order that she could come out of dock and take her part again in the battles, during which time the dockyard was being mercilessly pounded by the enemy aircraft, and the Kassoon, that is the gate of the dry dock, was damaged and the pumps were out of action, so that water was pouring into the dock at the same time as the shipwrights were standing up to their chests in water welding the bottom.